the graduate students that come to study here, and for me personally, who work in the area of environmental ethics and resource policy and planning. And it gives me very great pleasure this morning to be able to introduce to you Michal Smart, who is a master's student who's been here this past year, working in the area of Jewish environmental education. Michal did her bachelor's degree at Princeton with a major in religion and philosophy. She took out 2 years during her undergraduate work to study in a traditional yeshiva in Israel, went back to Princeton, and then after her studies at Princeton, spent a year on a Fulbright scholarship studying Jewish philosophy with an emphasis on women's issues and Jewish philosophy also in Israel. She's worked for 2 or 3 years in the area of Jewish education with some focus on environmental education. And this next fall, I'm very, very sad to report she plans to go to Harvard. Her husband is starting at Harvard Law School, and the two of them can't be two places at once. She'll continue working on her Cornell degree, but we'll do it in absentia. I say with great sadness because it's been a tremendous pleasure, Michal, the many wonderful conversations we've had this year. Michal is one of the relatively few students I've had who's thoroughly literate in Jewish scriptures and Talmud and in other areas that constituted part of my doctoral studies, and to be able to jump right into issues without a lot of explanation has been just a great delight to me this past year, so I'm going to miss you very much. She is going to lecture to us this morning on a Jewish philosophy of environmental education, and I'll let her do any further introduction of the topic herself.
Does that work? Okay.
Maybe a little higher.
Higher?
I think that's okay.
Does that work? Okay. First, some apologies to the people who came to this lecture when I gave it a few weeks ago. I have actually made a few changes, so you won't be completely bored. I'm not actually going to focus so much on education today, as much as my goal in the short time that we have is to give you a little taste of Jewish environmental ethics, the kind of things that people like me spend all our time thinking about. Now, to most people, when I talk about this subject, I first need to explain, you know, why there is such a thing as Jewish environmental ethics at all, because people's primary question is, what does religion have to do with the environment in any case? It's my firmest hope at this point in the semester that all of you would join me in having a good answer for those people. And that answer, at least for me, begins with the recognition that the problems that we commonly refer to as the environmental crisis are actually only symptoms of what is more essentially a crisis of values. Questions like, do we care about our impact on other species or faraway ecosystems? Do we believe, let's say, that old-growth trees are worth more in the form of lumber than they are standing? This, of course, has been a major theme of the course, so I'm not going to dwell on it here. I would assert at the beginning, just as a reminder, that all conservation and all environmentalism, ultimately, is founded on a belief that there is inherent value in the continued existence of the world as we know it. Whether this is grounded in a sense of wonder at what exists, or whether it ultimately boils down to a belief in the value of preserving our own species. Conservation of necessity entails what Alvin Weinberg has called trans-science. In fact, I would argue that the question of how we should treat our natural environment is inherently a religious question, because it addresses whether life has meaning, and if it does, how we are to live in accordance with that truth. Now, Judaism, of course, has a particular worldview, as well as an extensive written and oral tradition on which its philosophy of the natural world, as well as its philosophy on just about everything you can think of, is based. And before I get into what I perceive that philosophy to be, I want to give you just two quick disclaimers. The first one is the problem with saying Judaism says X. Because Judaism, as most of you know, is not a monolith. It's a tradition which is thousands of years old and encompasses a complexity of voices which are rooted in different places, radically different historical periods and understandings of the world. So when I say Judaism says this, or what I'm presenting is a Jewish philosophy, what that means is that it's based on an honest interpretation and understanding of traditional sources, trying to take them on their own terms while using them to address problems that are in some sense unique to our generation. The rabbis 4,000 years ago didn't talk about limited resources or not in the language that we think about it now. So that's an inherent tension in doing a Jewish ethic of this kind. Which kind of ties into the second disclaimer, which is that there is no explicit environmental ethic in Judaism. You can't open it up and read it the way you can Singer or Regan and have, you know, point A, point B, point C. This is what we have to say about the natural world. It's a process of extrapolating from what we have to address the questions that we need to answer. I'm one of a handful of people that are just starting to ask these questions of Jewish tradition. So what I tell you is of necessity also influenced by my own views and my own questions. And it's kind of a philosophy that's in the process of being written. So I'm hoping just to share some of these ideas with you. I have a traveling microphone here. Because so much of what I'm going to be talking about, at least in terms of the text, is probably foreign to most of you, I put together a little overhead. You don't need to learn it or anything like that, but it will give you a sense of the outline of what I'm talking about so you can follow along with the logic of what I'm saying, hopefully. And then at the bottom, I've just identified some of the key Jewish sources that I'm going to be referring to in the course of the lecture. So if some of you have no idea what the Talmud is or what a Midrash is, kind of glance up there. It's your handy-dandy reference to know what I'm talking about. So, does Judaism have anything to say about the environmental crisis? How would we begin to articulate a Jewish philosophy of the natural world? My initial answer to this is twofold. The first is that from the very first days of creation, through the desert of Sinai, to the fields of the land of Israel, Jewish tradition is absolutely replete with texts and traditions which explicitly address our relationship to the natural world in some way. Secondly, because discussion of environmental ethics ultimately concerns a fundamental encounter between human being, God, and the world, the ecologically relevant material within the tradition is absolutely vast and incredibly multifaceted. Whether it's agricultural laws or the story of creation or a reading of Psalms, the observance of the Sabbath, recitation of blessings, the laws of keeping kosher, just about every aspect of Jewish life and law in some way comes together to present a worldview and a way of life which has a lot to teach us about our relationship to our natural environment. And based on the study that I've done in the last few years of traditional sources, I've put together what I call five fundamental tenets of a Jewish environmental ethic. They're up there, so you can follow along. The first, I think, is really the most important, and in a certain sense, everything else I have to say stems from this. And that is the Jewish belief that this world is God's creation. A Jewish philosophy of the natural world, just like a Jewish philosophy of anything, has to begin, in essence, where the Torah begins, with the absolute assumption, unquestioned, of God's existence and the divine creation of heaven and earth. Now, Professor Barris touched on this a little bit, but I'd like to explore it further because I think it's so important. The Torah's portrayal of God as creator is understood in the words of the psalmist to imply that the earth belongs to God and all that fills it, the world and all its inhabitants. There's a popular belief which is attributed at least to Lynn White in the 1960s. Jim is helping me figure out just how much of this Lynn White actually said and how much has become attributed to him later. But in any case, there is a very, very widespread belief that you see very, very frequently in environmental writing that the, quote, Judeo-Christian tradition, and specifically the creation account in Genesis, is in some way responsible for our bad thinking about the environment and in some ways has contributed to the mess that we've created and we're trying to get out. And they say this because they believe or they perceive that this biblical account puts human beings at the center of the universe and all of the earth basically at our feet to exploit at our will. So it's specifically to this perception that I want to talk about the story. And before I do that, I want to say that there definitely has been a certain tendency in Judaism, perhaps in Christianity also, to emphasize the importance of human beings over and against a more balanced biocentric view. I think there's really no question of that. And to some extent, the Jewish community is coming into a process of realizing the importance of thinking about things in a new way, just as the American community at large is undergoing a similar process. Is this working? Thank you. At the same time, in my opinion, absolutely nothing in Jewish literature has ever taken the place of human beings to such an extreme position. And in fact, the idea that the world is absolutely ours and we have carte blanche to exploit it at will is, in my opinion, antithetical to a Jewish view of the world. And I'm going to point out just a few things about that story. Adam, who in a closer reading, the text truly represents humankind. In fact, the rabbis understood Adam to be a hermaphrodite, both male and female at the same time, is depicted as part of the creation. And the narrative in many ways stresses the importance of other species, as well as the commonality between Adam, humanity, and the rest of creation. For instance, God commands every grass, herb, and tree into existence, as well as commands them to propagate indefinitely, each according to its own kind. Not only the commandment, but the blessing to be fruitful and multiply is also given to all species of fish and birds. And, of course, one thing that's repeated again and again in the story is that all of creation, even before the introduction of humanity onto the world scene, is deemed by God to be good in its own right and independent of any reference to human beings. Moreover, even after the famous and in many ways challenging sentence which commands human beings to fill the earth and subdue it, to have dominion over every living thing that moves, the very next sentence limits human beings to eating only vegetation. According to the story of creation, we're not given permission to eat animals at all. So even after that sentence, the very next thing gives us absolute limits on our consumption of the world and what we can take from it. And I think it's important to notice these things. I won't go on and on about it, but it's my firmest conviction that a faithful reading of this story bears little resemblance to the strictly anthropocentric reading that has been attributed to it. So, again, our starting point is that the world belongs to God, and for this reason, it is not humankind's to exploit at will. I'm going to move on now to the second point. Oh, actually, I wanted to say something else before that. Jewish law, which many of you might not be familiar with, is tremendously picayune. I mean, it tells you everything you can do, everything you can't do from the time you get up to the time you go to sleep. And I think it's important in this sense, because when we talk about American society and our ideas of radical personal autonomy and the difficulty of environmental ethicists coming and saying to people, you can't just do what you want, that what you feel you want to do in the moment is not the highest value of how you can act, and perhaps even considering imposing legislation which would restrict people's individual humans or actions or private property rights or things like that. The Jewish community has always had an understanding of that, that the well-being of the community, the well-being of future generations, takes precedence in many instances over personal autonomy and fulfilling your desires in the moment. So the halakha, the Jewish law, by definition delineates which parts of the world are allowable to us and when, and which are forbidden. Therefore, the Torah's position grants human beings a status distinct from other plants and animals. I don't think there's any question of that, while simultaneously justifying absolute limits on human behavior and on our use of God's world. Thus, what I consider a theocentric view of the world, one which puts God at the center, stands in opposition both to biocentrism, which says that human beings don't have a unique status, and to anthropocentrism, which says there's no absolute limits and the world is ours to use as we wish. Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, one of my favorite Jewish philosophers, said the following: "The world is too wondrous to be fully comprehended in relation to man. The world and its ultimate significance must be understood in relation to God, for all things are his servants." Now I'm getting to point two, the purposiveness of everything in creation, which is, I think, the Jewish way of articulating the value of biodiversity, or I think it has potential to talk about that. Now, why do I say this? The Bible's portrayal of the world as a deliberate creation and purposive creation of God implies, obviously, that there is divine intention in the existence of every species of animal and plant that exists on the planet. Midrash Rabbah states this explicitly. It says, quote, "Even things that you perceive to be superfluous in the world, such as flies, gnats, and mosquitoes, even they are included in the scheme of creation. As it is written, and heaven and earth were finished, and all of their hosts." Concerning plant life, Rabbi Simon once said, "There is not a single blade of grass which does not have a star in heaven, which watches over it and tells it, grow." Accordingly, Ben Zoma instructed his students, "Do not be scornful of any person, and do not be disdainful of anything, for there is no person which does not have his hour, and no thing which does not have its place." Now, the purpose of design of such an overwhelming variety of species and creatures ultimately casts diversity itself as a source of wonder. The psalmist thus declares, "How many are your works, O God? All of them you made in wisdom. The earth is filled with your possessions." Likewise, diversity among human beings is perceived to evince God's greatness. In the Mishnah, it stated that God created humanity out of one individual in order to relate the greatness of God. For if a human being impresses several coins with the same seal, they're all going to resemble each other identically. But the King of Kings, the Holy One, blessed be He, impressed every person with the seal of Adam, the first human being, but not a single one of them is just like the other. I think if we take this view of diversity among human beings and apply the evolutionary insights that we've gained in the last century or two, it becomes a tremendously powerful statement also of the value of biodiversity on a larger scale. The third point has to do with the perception of God acting in the daily functioning of the natural world. In the daily morning service that all traditional Jews recite each morning, Jews bless God, quote, "who renews each day, always, the act of creation." While evening prayers bless God who causes evening and orders the stars into their heavenly constellations. Seen in this light, the everyday functioning of the natural world also appears as a source of wonder, and the prosaic essentially as miraculous. Thus, these same prayers include thanking God, quote, "for your miracles that are with us every day, and for your wonders and goodness which are with us at every moment, evening, morning, and noon." When we talk about the question of how ethics are really transmitted, and read some of the feminist authors about maybe there's really an ethic of care and it's not abstract, I think that the way the Jewish prayer and tradition has incorporated a sense of wonder into everyone's daily life not only serves to acknowledge and be grateful for the things that we see, but I think it also inculcates or cultivates a personality which is sensitive to the wonder of the things around us. And I think it provides a fabulous educational model for how wonder and appreciation of the natural world might be taught. My next point has to do with the connection between social and ecological justice, which especially in light of some of the readings we've reviewed in this class more recently, I think is one of the most important insights that the Jewish tradition has to offer the field of environmental ethics. Judaism sees an integral connection between social, meaning human justice, and ecological, meaning between humans and the rest of creation, justice. Time and again, when you read through the Bible or you read through Jewish law, specific observances contain both of these elements really strongly interwoven and grounded in the same philosophy. And I want to give you just one example of that, which is Shanat Shemitah, the Shemitah year, which I think in English is usually called the sabbatical year, which is primarily defined as a Sabbath for the earth, for the land. It says in Leviticus, "And the Lord spoke to Moses at Mount Sinai, saying, speak to the children of Israel, and say to them, when you come into the land which I give you, the land shall observe a Sabbath to the Lord." As a consequence of this Shabbat, which is celebrated by the earth, privately owned land was deemed legally ownerless, and standard cultivation of crops was forbidden for the entire year. One striking aspect of Shemitah observance was a procedure called biur, which necessitated that once a given food was no longer available to wild animals out in the field, the same item had to be removed immediately from all human domiciles and deemed ownerless. So if the olives had gone bad or, you know, were no longer available on the trees, that day you had to take all the olives out of your house and give them away, consider them ownerless. In most cases, they were then eaten by the poor of the community. It's an absolutely amazing, amazing practice, which I won't go into further. But I think it really did serve, and this is part of the philosophy of the Shanat Shemitah, to deflate the chasm between human being and wild animal, and somehow to bring a slightly bit closer human society to the natural world. Now, significantly, the Shemitah of land was accompanied by a Shemitah of money, in which all outstanding monetary debts among Jews were forbidden in an effort to eliminate poverty within the nation. Shemitah thus addresses, in one observance, both inequity within the social realm and also inequity between human beings and the rest of creation. And again, this is just one example. Now, particularly at a time when the vast majority of our toxic dumps, landfills, and trash incinerators and the like are being built in poor and predominantly black neighborhoods, the connection between these two realms of concern, I believe, is profound. It guards against the misanthropy of certain deep ecologists or biocentrists, some of the things that I find scary reading Calicut, for instance. And at the same time, from a theocentric point of view, it states that the welfare of human beings cannot be addressed in isolation from concern for other species. But nor can we, in our concern for the planet, place an unfair burden on the socially disenfranchised or override the ultimate dignity of the human being. Both of these realms of concern go hand in hand, and justice can't be achieved when either of them is not yet achieved. What am I doing? The last main point I wanted to bring up was the issue of spirituality, which I won't go into in great detail. When we read Sachs, many of you will recall, he talked about his belief that a certain kind of experience of the natural world has the capacity to refine a human being. And Judaism would concur, because any Jewish environmental ethic concerns itself not only with policies and practices and things of that nature, but also with the influence of our relationship with the natural world on the spiritual well-being of every person. Now, the Jewish people spent 40 years in the wilderness between Egypt and Israel, and the record of that experience essentially dominates the biblical narrative. While the specific depictions of the wilderness that we experience there vary throughout the Bible, almost all references testify to the fact that that experience of the wilderness was spiritually intense and ultimately uplifting. Rabbi Yehoshua said, "Why did Yitro go with them into the wilderness?" Because he foresaw that the Israelites would be uplifted by the wilderness and elevated there. As it is said, "Who is she that rises up from the desert?" In fact, the rabbis understood the experience of wilderness to comprise an essential aspect of the Jewish people's achieving freedom from slavery. The Talmud states, "If a person makes him or herself like the wilderness, the Torah is given to him like a gift." The Talmud also teaches that thunder was created in order to straighten the crooked places in the human heart. In other words, the natural world has the capacity to affect and to refine the human being who encounters it. In fact, elsewhere in a text I didn't put up there called Tanchuma, it mentions that a person who fails to recite blessings over the rising and setting sun as they live is considered to be spiritually dead, even as that person is alive. Now, modern culture, to overgeneralize for a minute because my time is short, has largely objectified the natural world, seeing the earth itself and other beings who inhabit it as natural resources, things which are potentially useful to human beings, but without purpose or value in themselves. Such a perception to the world is numbing to the human spirit and underlies in many ways the excessive appetite and the reckless behavior of contemporary Western society towards the natural world. In contrast, countless Jewish sources maintain that it is precisely in their aliveness that other faces of creation testify to God's presence in the world and can serve as a catalyst for our own sense of aliveness and spiritual growth. In the eyes of one Midrash, every creature bears a unique message from God. The Holy One, blessed be He, it says, said to the prophets, "If you will not deliver my message, I have messengers. With everything, I send my messages." Rav Acha said, "With everything, the Holy One, blessed be He, sends a message, even with serpents, even with frogs, even with scorpions, and even with mosquitoes." In addition, many Jewish texts portray what we call nature as an infinite host of sentient beings who actively praise God. Psalm 148 says, "Praise the Lord from the heavens. Praise God from the heights. Praise God, all stars of light. Let them praise the name of the Lord, for He gave command and they were created. Praise the Lord from the earth, fire and hail, snow and vapors, stormy winds fulfilling His word, mountains and all hills, fruit trees and all cedars, wild animals and all cattle, that which creeps and birds of the wing, kings of the earth and all peoples, men and women, old and young." In fact, in biblical and rabbinical Hebrew, there's absolutely no word for nature. This was my sense when I first started researching, and since then I've checked it time and time again with people who know a bunch more than I do. There's simply no word for nature in the Bible or in rabbinic literature. Because in truth, what we call nature is not one tiny piece of reality that we can separate from the rest and live without. When we come into nature, or what we sometimes call wilderness, we are witnessing life itself, the world of God's creation, of which we are an integral and inseparable part. Therefore, we can learn about ourselves and even discover aspects of ourselves only through this essential encounter. In the Hebrew language in which the Torah is written, humankind is formed and called Adam from the word Adama, which means earth. Again, Rabbi Heschel said, "To think of God, man must hear the world. Man is not alone in celebrating God. To praise God is to join all things in their song to Him. Our kinship with nature is a kinship of praise, because all beings praise God. We live in a community of praise." And before I finish, what I wanted to do is give you some ideas of how these ideas that I've extracted from traditional texts actually become embodied in Jewish life and practice, as well as how some of these ideas I'm actually extrapolating, not from scripture or text, but from Jewish law and practices. The first one could be a lecture in and of itself, and I'm just going to skim over it, which has to do with the extensive body of agricultural laws, which had legal effect when the Jewish people resided in the land of Israel. Today, many people follow them, but many people don't, since the state of Israel obviously is not a theocracy, it's not a religious state politically. But to some extent, one can look at the relationship through the agricultural laws of the Jewish people in the land of Israel as a paradigm for the relationship of humanity on the earth in general. Is that clear? Kind of a microcosm of the larger situation. One important point is that land was not owned in Israel. And even today, actually, there's no such thing as private ownership of land in Israel. You get 99-year leases for your house or for your home. Some of the ways that this was explained, and this is interesting, I think, in terms of the readings, Professor Baer, that you gave us this week, the overriding concern that comes up again and again for private property. There simply is no such thing, ultimately, from a Jewish perspective. Some examples of how that was expressed: when a person cultivated his or her field, they couldn't cultivate it completely. They left the corners bare as a way of acknowledging that they did not have complete ownership and control of that land. Similarly, when you grew, let's say, a fruit tree, and if it was an apple tree, you might have waited, you know, we wait 20 years for natural apple trees. We don't have so many natural ones anymore, but when we did, for them to come into fruit. Nonetheless, for the first 3 years that that tree or crop came into fruit, you could not take of it. And until you brought it to the temple as a sacrifice, which is a passage that you brought, Professor Baer brought for us to see at some point earlier, you could not have use. Even if you planted it, you grew it, it was on your property, it absolutely was not yours, and you could not take it until those 3 years had passed and the sacrifice was completed. Also, people took a certain portion of their produce and had to give it both to the temple for the people who worked there and also to the poor of the society. Likewise, when you harvested your crops, especially then, there was a certain lack of efficiency in the equipment and the things they would do. Lots of things would fall by the wayside. You could never go back and pick up, you know, all the wheat and all the produce that you had dropped. It had to be left in the field, both for the people who were poor and did not own land, and also for the wild animals to be able to come and take it. So even in the process of cultivating the land, there was a certain acknowledgement in practice as well as in theory that we did not have absolute ownership or control. And again, both of these elements coincided, the concern for humanity's relationship with the animals that lived around us and also for the socially disenfranchised people within the community. Another thing I wanted to mention is the recitation of blessings, which is a very, very important and kind of constantly occurring aspect of Jewish life. What it does is embody and practice the idea that the world belongs to God, because we do not have permission to eat unless we acknowledge that we're eating something we've been given specific permission to eat by God, whose property it ultimately is. The Talmud states, quote, "It is forbidden to enjoy anything from this world without a blessing." Rav Chanina Bar Papa said, "Anyone who enjoys something from this world without a blessing, it is as if he steals from the Holy One, blessed be he." Now, a third aspect of Jewish law is a huge body of laws, which in Hebrew is called Tzar Ba'alei Chaim, which is understood as the prohibition for humans to cause the suffering of living creatures. Now, really what that comes down to is a prohibition to cause unnecessary or excessive suffering of living creatures, since Judaism at the same time permits the use of animals for labor, clothing, food, and the like. But at the same time, the animal's experience of life is never completely disregarded. The Torah has several laws which entreats people always to treat animals with compassion. For example, it's forbidden to muzzle your ox as he's working in the field, because it would be cruel if he's working hard and he gets hungry to see all this food around and not be able to eat. We are also commanded explicitly in the Bible to relieve the burden of a struggling animal, even if it belongs to your enemy. Now, the Talmud and the rabbis expanded these laws extensively. For instance, they declared that a Jew cannot eat until his or her animals have been fed, and it's forbidden to buy an animal unless you have the means to feed it and take care of it. The Shehecheyanu, which is a prayer of thanksgiving that's traditionally said every time we wear a new garment, among other occasions, is prohibited to be said for wearing leather shoes out of deference to the loss of the life of the animal. The rabbis scorned inflicting pain or death upon animals in the name of sport or entertainment. Hunting is prohibited by Jewish law, for example. And the rabbis declared, quote, "The one who sits in a stadium spills blood." The prohibition to tear a limb from a living animal, which is considered the most extreme example of insensitivity and cruelty to animals, is one of the seven laws of Noah, the Noahide laws, which in Jewish view is essential to any moral society and binding not only on the Jewish people, but actually upon all of humanity. Also, another topic in itself that I'll just mention here are the laws of kashrut, the laws of keeping kosher, which have many, many elements within them of sensitivity to animals, from what kind of animals are kosher to eat, to the method of slaughter that's employed, to the separation of meat and milk. All of these, in my opinion, are basically designed to inculcate sensitivity to the person consuming that animal of the moral ambiguities of doing so. And in fact, today there's a widespread debate among the Jewish community about whether Jewish laws and ethics actually require people to become vegetarian or not. There's different views about that. But in any case, Tzar Ba'alei Chaim, this particular aspect of Jewish law, I think is the most akin to kind of the animal rights philosophies that we've been reading, in the sense that it has paramount concern for the suffering of an individual animal. It's certainly not identical to animal rights because it's sensitive to their suffering within the context of their exploitation for human use. And it's focused specifically on, thank you, on domestic animals and not animals in the wild. Okay, I've gotten my 10-minute reminder here. Oh, I'm doing pretty good. The other point that I wanted to mention to you is Shabbat, the Jewish Sabbath. Now, the Jewish Sabbath is considered first and foremost a way of remembering the act of creation. Jews bear witness to God as creator by curtailing our cultivation and our use of the earth's resources, because the primary thing that characterizes the Sabbath is the prohibition of labor. Moreover, traditional Sabbath observance carves a space in our busy lives for spiritual experience, for time with family, for enjoying non-material aspects of living, things which have a potential to cultivate a personality and a lifestyle which is more ecologically sound. In his book, How Much is Enough?, Alan Durning writes that if we are to curtail our ecologically destructive pattern of consumption, we must cultivate the deeper, non-material sources of fulfillment that bring happiness. Rabbi Heschel wrote in his words, "To set apart one day a week for freedom, a day on which we would not use the instruments which have so easily been turned into weapons of destruction, a day for being with ourselves, a day of detachment from the vulgar, of independence of external obligations, a day on which we stop worshiping the idols of technical civilization, a day of armistice in the economic struggle with our fellow human beings and with the forces of nature. Is there any institution which holds out greater hope for man's progress than the Sabbath?" In conclusion, I just want to state what I hope you've gotten a taste of and would agree with me easily at this point, which is that the Jewish religious tradition declares emphatically that the well-being of this world is a Jewish concern. As countless sources demonstrate, the ongoing and escalating destruction of the natural environment violates specifically Jewish laws and values and is antithetical to an understanding of the world as a purpose of creation of God. It is my hope and prayer that our religious traditions, with their abundant riches of narratives, values, and ritual observances, can serve as a resource itself for the healing of our relationship with the natural world and the development of sustainable and ethical practices. That's it. Thanks.
There's us at least 10 minutes, 12 minutes for comments and questions. I also wanted just to mention, for those of you who missed the handouts on last Thursday, there are those individual pieces here. I forgot the elephant piece. That's over in the office. And you can pick those up here if you missed them on Thursday. But you have just a little over 10 minutes, about 12 minutes for a discussion.
Sure.
First, I thank you for sharing that. You mentioned earlier.
Nice and loud.
Sorry. You mentioned earlier about God's vegetarian creation, and I agree, it's very clear that God created us to be vegetarians. I'm just curious, this is sort of what I'm doing my paper on. What's your take on Genesis chapter 8, wherein God tells Moses that it's okay, where God tells Noah that it's okay to eat?
What you're asking is the heart of the debate, really, about vegetarianism. What he's referring to is, as I mentioned before, in the Garden of Eden, or the story of Genesis, human beings are not given permission to eat animals. So your immediate question might be, well, then what happened? What changed? And in reading the biblical narrative, what changes is the aggression that overrides the world during the generation of Noah. And it's specifically after this widespread violence and the cessation of the flood that human beings are given permission to eat animals, but specifically in such a way, ideally, that it's going to inculcate sensitivity to life and not let this widespread violence and aggression overrun people. And I think, this is what I did in my paper actually on last semester, that underlying the debate about vegetarianism in Jewish tradition has to do with an understanding of that specific event. Some people understand it just as a temporary concession. You know, that generation was not capable of sustaining the highest ethical vision of how human beings should relate to animals. So as a kind of temporary, very circumstantial concession, we were permitted to eat animals, but in such a way, eventually, so we would learn not only not to eat animals, but not to be violent at all. People who take that view of that tend to think we should be vegetarianism. You know, like, if that's what this is all designed to teach us, it's been thousands of years, don't we get it already? You know, so, let's take the next step and let's be vegetarian. other people saying no, that it wasn't a circumstantial concession at all, that somehow what happened is that the experiment, so to speak, with humans living on our highest ethical ideal failed. And it failed because of something that's integral to human nature, not because of something that that particular generation was just not ready to get yet. And they would consider it a mistake, kind of what Professor Baer has talked about sometimes, of trying to, if you try and realize that ideal vision prematurely, it will somehow backfire on you. These people would believe that until something radical happens, until the redemption comes, until the nature of the world changes in some fundamental way, people are not ready to take that extra step yet. And that's what became acknowledged at that point in the biblical narrative. So I think you could read it either way, and I think it's essentially tied up in the question of vegetarianism. Any other questions?
Could you say just a little bit about what you hope to do in environmental education for Jews, some of the plans you're making, and I find some of that very, very exciting. I'm just delighted that you're working on it. Could you share with us just a little bit of what you're hoping to do?
Sure. Actually, in terms of what I'm hoping to do, I've been struggling with a lot of the issues that were raised in this class about how ethics can be taught. What I've shared with you today in the context of a formal lecture is more along the lines of Regan and Singer. You know, it's a philosophy, it's an ethic, it's very abstract and theoretical, but it contains a lot of important values that I think have potentially transformative power in our society. So part of what I'm doing is exactly what I've shared with you today, studying traditional texts, trying to articulate a Jewish philosophy of the natural world. And through textual study and lectures and things of that nature, trying to share those values and ideas with people. At the same time, I don't think that's all of the story. I think often so much of our values do have to do with what's in our personal experience, what have we come to know personally and care about. So part of what I've been doing these last few years is also leading wilderness expeditions for Jewish people, especially Jewish people who are highly, highly urbanized in this country. And often don't have any direct wilderness experience at all. So I lead wilderness trips, sometimes just afternoon nature walks, sometimes month-long expeditions, trying to create and establish a relationship between the Jewish people and the natural world. And in the context of that kind of a trip, try and cultivate the spiritual experiences and share some of the ideas that I've talked about today. And my ultimate vision that I'm working towards right now is actually establishing a school of Jewish outdoor and environmental education, where school groups and families and individuals will be able to come and study some of these sources, experience a rich exposure to Jewish life, and try and do both of those pieces together. That's what I'm doing now. Yeah, Carl. I need to think about that more to give you a fuller answer, but my gut reaction would be no, I don't think so. For instance, a lot of the groups that say that you've been involved with, the Outward Bound model, don't only go into the wilderness to experience it and enjoy it in kind of easy, revelatory way, but also acknowledge the physical and the emotional challenges of being in a wilderness environment and consider that an essential part of the educational process and the richness of the experience. You know, likewise, it's really not that far between Egypt and Israel. I mean, it is no 40 years walk, you know. And so some of the texts say, you know, why did they go this way? I mean, why didn't they just go, you know, through the land of Plishtim? Why didn't they go around that way? And actually the answer that comes up is Kikarovhu. It was too close. It was too easy. If the Jewish people had just walked from here to there, we'd have still been where we were when we left, so to speak. So the experience of the wilderness, the extended time, and even the hardships was considered an integral and a deliberate part of that process, deliberately chosen, in a way that I think is very analogous, actually, to people deliberately choosing, you know, to leave their very comfortable suburban lifestyles right now and go out and experience the wilderness more directly. That would be just one part of an answer, but I actually think it's very closely connected. The second part I would say, I guess, is that Jewish life, in a sense, tries to create a balance. You know, it definitely doesn't say that everyone should go out and live in the wilderness. The Jewish people have never Well, a few people in Israel actually do, but in general, Jewish people haven't adopted that kind of a lifestyle. But what we do have is holidays, let's say the holiday of Sukkot, where we specifically are supposed to remember what it was like to live in the wilderness. And you're commanded for an entire week not to live in your house. You have to build a temporary, flimsy structure through which you can see the stars and the rain can fall on you and sleep and eat outside. It's basically a commandment, like, to go camping for an entire week, you know. Likewise, the holiday of Passover, you know, each person is encouraged to regard him or herself as if they personally went out of Egypt, and you're supposed to try and recapture the experience of being in the desert. There's prayers and rituals which try and bring that experience back into our consciousness and into our experience, even as we live in modern society all the time. So I think that kind of a balance of living within society, but also trying to keep alive some of the lessons and insights and personal growth that was achieved and can only be achieved in a more natural environment, is more of the model that Jewish life tries to get. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that's an excellent question. This is one of the things that I'm the most interested in right now. And I don't have an easy answer for you. What he's asking is if from a religious perspective we state that everything has inherent value as a creation of God, how do we reconcile that belief with the vast extinctions that have taken place over time? You know, the fact that in one particular time, I think in the Triassic period, 96% of everything that existed became extinct. You know, the more recent and more famous extinction spasm after that. It's a wonderful question, and it's something I've been thinking a lot about. It's the kind of question that makes someone like me think on my feet, because obviously the rabbis, you know, didn't know about the extinctions. And even today, actually, certain very, very traditional Jewish communities will not even accept the historical fact of extinctions. And most people talk about extinctions aren't too concerned about the purpose of creations of God. I don't have an easy answer for you. Not really. Largely because of the statements that were made and then, you know, later extrapolated from Lynn White in the 1960s. I would say for a good 20 or 25 years, everything that was written about environmental ethics from a Jewish perspective was just defensive. It was basically trying to say that we're not just anthropocentrics, that we're not so awful, and kind of creating very superficial survey articles, you know. Take this quotation from here, take this practice from there, and just kind of throw out a whole bunch of examples of how green Judaism is, and never really getting much beyond the surface with any of them. And it's really only more recently that anyone's trying to ask those really hard, more sophisticated questions like the one that you've just raised. In fact, the first conference or meeting ever to take place in history about Jewish environmental ethics is happening this coming May. If I have an answer after that, I'll get back to you. Do we have time for one more?
We've got about 1 minute yet. One more. There was one over there for Craig.
Yeah, I just have a small question. I've really never heard of Jewish environmental ethics until you brought it up to us. How new is it? Seeing that there's going to be the first conference. How many people can you say?
How many people consider it their primary field of study? I'd say there's two or three of us, to be honest. The question,
Thanking McDowell for this.
Thank you.
Very well done. Thank you so much.
Oh, great.
Just really well done. Very nice.